This is Pam Electric Ghost, and we're live on the air. Kay Chan, multi-talented freelance presentation engineer. So we want to welcome you to the Pam Electric Ghost podcast. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited to be here. I mean, I'm hoping things will be pleasant because I'm very, very new to this.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah, we're a live podcaster, so that can be intimidating to some folks because we don't actually edit. We do it live like a radio interview. But we find that that allows us to be kind of like in the moment, kind of flow state. And we, you know, being a creative person, we find that that's, it generates an interesting conversation. So one of the first things we always ask anybody who joins the podcast is like, what motivates you and why do you do what you do?
That's a very good question. What motivates me? I think, honestly, it should be my job and what I do and what passion I have for it. But I'm sure everyone can agree that, you know, even having a passion for your job and doing great at what you do, it ends up being work nonetheless. And you kind of get lost in that, that it no longer becomes fun per se. It's not something that you do as a hobby anymore. It's just something that you do to survive. What really gets me up in the morning is my one-year-old daughter. I think everybody says that, you know, it's either their kin or, you know, family member of some sort. And the other thing is golf. And you know what? Maybe not in that order.
That's great. But it's good to know, like, sometimes you gotta have boundaries, right? Like, cause sometimes, like, some people, you know, you get these executives, the CEOs, it's like their whole life is work, and then their families are like suffering because there's like no time spent with anybody, but the work is the driven thing. And when you can carve out, you know, the things that are important to you and create like boundaries for your spirit and your soul and your heart, it's like, it's not, work isn't everything we are. You know, sometimes it tends to be, but, you know, it's good to have balance.
Right. And don't get me wrong, Phantom. I mean, I didn't have that perspective 4 years ago. I mean, if you had asked me then, it would just be my job, you know, my work, the passion I have for it, or, you know, seeking perfection. I think those were the things that used to motivate me until I had my daughter, mm-hmm. until I discovered golf. And, you know, after that, it was more like, oh yeah, I'm working for them instead. And I'm working to have this other passion that I'm ridiculously addicted to. And, you know, my wife can't talk me out of.
Yeah, it's very important to kind of have the work-life balance. I think the pandemic kind of gave us some, you know, aspect of that, because like, if you were a workaholic and you're never home, there you were like forced to be home. Then you're like, oh, you're right. Like, can I enjoy my home or do I not enjoy my home? You know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, coming into the stage of where I am right now, my entire life was just work or seeking work. And, you know, it's been that vicious cycle over and over again. And it's weird because, having not known the greener pasture on the other side of the fence, I was so acclimated to the way I was living, so acclimated, so, you know, comfortable with it, that I didn't have other expectations. I just knew that what I was doing was something that provided for me. And at the same time, I don't exist otherwise without it. I don't know if you can, you know, agree with that statement, but that's essentially how I felt coming in prior to the pandemic.
Yeah, I think it's a really, you know, the pandemic caused like the great resignation, caused a lot of people to question like, why are they doing what they were doing? You know, I used to be on the kind of, you know, hamster wheel of being on a flight on Sunday, flying out to a client on, you know, up to Thursday, and then coming back and doing it again and again and again, just being a road warrior. And a lot of us thought that that's the way it should be, right? But then it's like, after the pandemic, we weren't doing that in the middle of the pandemic. Like, you're like, oh, suddenly we're home. It's like, oh, how do you balance that? Now you're at home. It's like, oh, how do I live at home? How do I operate at home?
I mean, what am I going to do with all this free time? You know,
Yeah.
it's kind of insane now that you really said it. Yeah, I mean, before the pandemic, that's all it was. Wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, commute 30 minutes to my corporate job, and rinse and repeat. And that's the thing too, was being paid that, $40, 40 hour salary, when you're working 60 hours a week. And
Yeah.
that vicious cycle is like, I don't know. I've gotten complacent with it. And it wasn't until the pandemic when I started to realize, hey, there's something more, you know?
Yeah, it starts to, a lot of people became, entrepreneurs, or like I went from being a salary guy to being a consultant, because I decided like, well, you know what? If I'm gonna work 60, 70 hours, I might as well get paid for my hours. And
Right.
if I have a setup where I could work remotely and then do those hours instead of spending the time in the Uber, spending the time at the airport, spending the time on the bus, I actually can spend the time for billable hours and actually do better and then have time to do things like this. Where
Exactly.
before, like if I'm at the 20 hours commuting, like I wasted, that's a lot of wasted time that I can now do, you do my passion things,
Right. I mean, I think the pandemic, as bad as it was, I think if people were in a different position where their mindset was to be more opportunistic, the pandemic actually opened a lot of doors for a lot of people to just be a lot more bold, you know? And
Because you finally had the time to do it, right? You finally had the time to actually be able to think with your thoughts, right? Because there's so many people who are on the train, like they're rolling on that railroad of the corporate world, the rat race, and they don't have time to try. Well, I want to try that idea, but I don't have time to try that idea. Well, now you can.
Exactly. It like that opportunity is no longer just stuck in your head. You have the open field to just seek it out, make it happen. If anything, it's the opportunity to try and fail.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with failure, because a lot of times, like being an artist, I would point out, if you're a singer, songwriter, or producer, like I would say, a lot of our time, most of that stuff, you could look at that as a failure. Like if we spend all this time and then we only have like 5 minutes of what we actually produced is what is usable out of hours worth of work. You could look at that as like, well, that looks like a lot of wasted time, but like it's the way you look at it. Is it half full or half an empty? Like, is the experience of getting to that point where you had all these things were kind of didn't work and then this one did, is that the happy accident, or the work you did, is that something you think was a waste of time, or was that valuable to you?
I absolutely empathize with you in that regard. I mean, as an artist, or illustrator in the design world, whatever spectrum you're in, I think specifically in the creative field, is that you're never going to excel any better unless you're making those mistakes. And I lived, what, a good 40 some odd years of making constant mistakes. But they're always new mistakes. It's not the same mistakes, and having learned from that, and having grown from that, I think that's key to actually perfecting what it is that we want out of life. Obviously your job, your passion, all that stuff. I mean, it's built out of failure.
Yeah, I mean, it's so important. So many people, we have so many tools that there's this tendency to want to have perfection. Like, I have a lot of tools where I can make something sonically seem perfect. But as an artist, what everybody starts to realize is imperfections have character. If you're a painter and you're doing something, certain brush strokes, it might be a mistake, but it has character. And same thing, like a lot of things that you do might, like we call the happy accident, like in inventing, right? If you do something as a scientist, there's a lot of happy accidents that are very profitable. And it's just the willingness to actually dive into it. If you had a project plan, and then suddenly something happened that wasn't on the plan, but it looked actually better than what you were doing, do you have the guts to actually say, maybe we should go this path? or do you want to just stay on the train and say, well, that's not on the path, so I'm not going to do it?
Right. I mean, absolutely right. Absolutely right. I mean, so many of my designs is just from experimenting, right? Understanding where it is that I want to go, and then setting a path for it. Along the way, I'm going to find something that's, you know, I didn't intend to do, but then I'm like, wait a minute, I think I might be onto something better, you know? And I bet with, I'm certain with musicians and artists and, you know, of all caliber, they go through the same thing. And like you said, those are very, very happy accidents. You know, if I just paved the way and got exactly what it was I want, I mean, sure, it'll be a quicker trip, but then I never would have discovered, you know, this better path.
Yeah, it's just like the experience of life. Like when you're going in life, there's like waves. You could be on the, you know, the top of the wave. You could be at the bottom of the crescent, or at the, you know, the bottom of it, right? And a lot of times it's like, as an artist, like a lot of times, like what happens is like the bad times, the bad experiences, the melancholy, the sadness actually drives a lot of our creativity. So it's the negative stuff that a lot of people say, well, I want to stay away from that. Well, learning how to actually use it and learn from it and then process it and not like be obsessed by it, but actually use it as a cathartic tool to move forward so that you have like a growth mindset. Right. It's very important to like have that lesson learned. You know, like you're saying, like the lessons learned, like life has given you that those things so that you can use your head, you know, your mind, what you were given to kind of like, oh, it's not always going to be perfect, but that's actually part of the trip.
Right. Right. I mean, that's I want to say that's 80% of getting over that type of adversity, to be honest with you. You know, making sure that, you know, I mean, as the old saying goes, you know, turning lemonade out of lemon. And it's, yeah, you know, but the key is to not being stuck. Yeah. The key is to not being so hyper-focused on that failure, but instead being more hyper-focused on what that failure can bring. I mean, I think a lot of us need to be a little bit more opportunistic of stuff like that. And you know what? In my own personal path, I think I found that out. I mean, a little late in my life, but eventually I think I finally understood it, and you know, I put it to work.
And then so different people are on different points in their path. And a lot of times I've talked to a lot of people who've gone through like, you know, trauma, and then they're wondering, like, once they get through it, it's like, why didn't I figure that out 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 20 years ago? But you're like, you are where you are.
Exactly.
And so like where you find it, you know, it's always good if it happens earlier, but you know, sometimes it's a benefit, because if you go through those things, it's like, again, we're talking about that life experience is like immeasurable. It gives right. you who you are. And if once you accept that, okay, well, that's where the path I was on. And once you have the ability to kind of learn how to process the internal and the external, and then like understand, it's like, there's like, you know, as an artist, we think about the muse, right?
Right.
Oh, there's this external thing that I can tap into and somehow I'm connected, and I can take what's inside and what's outside, whatever's happening right now, and kind of just turn into this like crazy soup that ends up being tasty and everybody likes it. You know, when they don't like it, and I learn from it.
Right, right. I mean, I'm pretty sure I've made some bad soups on my way here. So,
yeah, it's the chef kind of thing. It's like, oh yeah, you know, chefs are always going to experiment with that next recipe. They don't want to stick to the one they always had. You know, they're always coming up with something new.
Oh, but you know,
yeah.
it's all those mistakes, and then it's that one, you know, it's that one golden ingredient that just happens. That's like lightning strike. It just happens, and then all of a sudden, it's just pure magic. You know, you're going through so many, you know, as we talked about failure, so many failures, and then all you really need to do is just all that really needs to happen is that one perfect puzzle piece, you know, to get put in place. And then all of a sudden it's just magic. You're like, I don't even know how I created this, but this is freaking awesome now.
Yeah, it's just like sometimes a song comes to me, and just because I trust myself, because I've been playing like 30 years, and I could sit down and compose something on paper and think that's going to be great, right? And then what happens is the thing I do off the cuff is like a million times better. And there's this stuff going in my subconscious that I didn't realize. But once you pick up a guitar or pick up a piano, that stuff is there. And when you trust yourself, and I think it happens with painters, it happens with all types of creative people, it happens with, you know, somebody who's given a lecture and they read the room. And then they realize mid conversation, mid speech, oh, this isn't really kicking. I need to change this. And then in that moment, that lecture becomes a unique point in time. And then you can get a million views on YouTube or something, because they it just becomes a magical moment. And you're like, had no idea that was going to happen, but you trusted yourself to make it happen.
Right. I mean, we discussed a little bit about, you know, the trauma that manifests into, you know, these manifests into these positive things in our life later on. I'm actually curious, because you're the one that brought that up. I was wondering, what type of trauma are you thinking about?
Well, I'm a cancer survivor. And, and so when I was 27 years old, I had a level 3 sarcoma. And who I was prior to cancer is a different person than I am today. I was very scared of a lot of things. I was not willing to get out of my shell. I wouldn't have been talking on a podcast. I wouldn't be doing my own music. I was very kind of shy.
You were an introvert.
Introvert. So once I discovered that, you know, I was a musician, but I never wanted to sing my song. I'd give it to somebody else to sing it. I'd be playing in the back on the keyboard, but I would never want to be the front man. Right. So the post-cancer, I said, you know what? I survived it. What am I scared of? And then I actually went on to live in Japan for like 2 years and do things where people would have said, well, Keith, why would Keith so scared of things? He would never do that. And I did. So, I mean, I went and did things that people didn't expect based on who they know, you know, age 26, age 25 versus age 27, getting through something like that. And you don't have to go through something that traumatic to realize that maybe the path you're on is not satisfying, or it's not your like, you have limiting beliefs. But, you know, it doesn't hurt to actually, you know, sometimes the things happen to you and those pivotal moments, you know, they don't have to be cancer. They could be something else. But so, you know, you realize that becomes usable as a launch point.
Right. I mean, congratulations, by the way. That's amazing. I mean, it reminds me of a friend I actually lost to colon cancer. I mean, it was a struggle. He actually didn't tell me until, you know, he was on his final stage. You know, he didn't. Yeah, so
some people get scared of that. It's a scary thing.
It was scary. I can understand why he waited to tell me. But at the same time, oh my God, the floodgates of just what I was thinking about and how I was reacting to it emotionally. And, you know, it was the moment he told me, the stopwatch just started. You know, it's like, oh my goodness, you know, it's a ticking clock that's just winding down for me. And I'm like, I don't know what to do with it. Like, there's a plethora of things that I need to say and do, or, you know, or just be with him. But I find that it's like, I don't have the time, or he doesn't have the time. And we talk about trauma in a sense on a personal level for you. For me, it was indirect. If we're just talking about cancer itself, it was very indirect with me. But at the same time, it made me think in terms of like how short life really is. You know, the curveballs that, you know, that are thrown our way. And I put myself in his shoes, and I decide, and then I'm realizing, this could have easily just been me.
To figure it out. Yeah, that's a good way to do it. Cause if you can empathize with somebody, right, then you see the parallels in your life. And right. then you actually, it's a teaching moment for you.
Right. It is a teaching moment for me. I mean, I think I'm still traumatized by it to this day. But I mean, it wasn't that too long ago. It was only about 4 years ago when that happened. So, you know, I miss him to death. He's, you know, he was a staple part of my life. And I don't know, I kind of wish he had just told me sooner.
Yeah, it's a hard thing because, like, it's a hard thing to tell people the personal things, like, that are really deep. And the cancer scares you so much. And I found the thing, like, I told people, and some people were so freaked out about it, they couldn't handle the situation, and they kind of left my orbit. So it's an interesting thing. I've talked to other cancer survivors where, like, when they tell people, some people become like closer than they ever thought they ever would, and some people like disappear, right? Wow. So they, because they can't handle, like, you know, at least I found from other people I've talked to that's like a common thing that can happen, and it's kind of unexpected because you don't think people would do that, but, you know, it is the situation I've heard other survivors talk about.
That blows my mind. I, you know, that's nothing that I would ever expect. I mean, I would expect, you know, a surprise reaction, you know, being taken aback and, you know, you just gasp at the idea and, you know, maybe go silent for a little bit and you need your thought to process. But I never would expect, you know, your close friends or confidant and, you know, people that you rely on would just ghost you at the news of, you know, this terrible, horrible thing that's happened to you.
Well, it's kind of like what's going on with them, you know, because a lot of times what happens is they can't handle the mortality of it. Young people, like I happened when I was 27, and a lot of the kids, you know, they're under 30. They didn't want to think that could happen. So it's certain types of mindset is like, oh, that's a big downer. And they just, you know, and you can't, like, I can't control who they are. That's who they are. And so it's like, you know, if that's who you are, that's who you are. At least now I know who you are. So the way I just looked at it is a teaching moment for me. And eventually it's a teaching moment for them. Cause then they start relating, like, was that really who I am? So they can start, you know, some people came back later and said, oh, it felt really bad. I just didn't know how to handle it. You know, 10 years later, it's like, yeah, well, you know, that's who you were. I can't control that. But that's, you know, that's how you deal with life. You just, like, it's very unexpected how people handle trauma. It's like, you don't know what they're gonna do.
I mean, would you say that, you know, in that situation, are any of those friends, you know, or any of that friendship reconcilable?
There was a couple of people that they kind of explained to me where they were, what their head was at. And I'm a Buddhist, so I kind of, like, I didn't have a big problem. Like, the way I feel was, like, this is your path. You needed to go that way. If then now you're back in sync with me, that's fine. It's like law of attraction. Like, you went away because, like, my energy changed. You couldn't handle it, and now you're back in sync because somehow your energy has got to the same wavelength, and now we're back in sync. It's kind of woo woo, but, you know, that's the way I look at it.
Is it the same as before, or has the attraction weakened?
Well, in some cases, some people have got a stronger connection because they actually had to go through something, and they came back, and now they're more like open. Where before they were kind of closed off, and then other people, like, you know, they were on the same path of the same person they were. They were, you know, they I didn't really perceive a change. They just seemed to be they were there, and other people, right. You know, they just sometimes if you're on a path and people change, you know, like, you could evolve, and then somebody else, you have a group of people that don't, like, and they're still there, and you're somewhere else, and then now you're out of sync. So it's the way I look at it. I've run into, you know, situations where it's not as grave as that, but this, you know, somehow you change, and then people either are in your orbit or they kind of drop out.
Right. I mean, speaking of people out of my orbit, I mean, my father actually comes to mind. All right. I should probably start at the beginning, huh? If we talk about trauma, it's not just one instance for me. Let's talk about my passion. I love designing. I love illustration. I love the arts and all that. And I've always loved that. But going back to how that manifested, I mean, we're dating it all the way back to early 19, what, early 1980s, right? During that time, my parents, with myself and three of my siblings, we escaped the Cambodian War. For for listeners out there who don't know what war this is, you could Google the Khmer Rouge. It decimated over 2 million of our people. We barely escaped it. We were refugees in Thailand, and then eventually became refugees in America. And we had situated ourselves in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is the second most populated Asian city in America, second to Long Beach. So in a way, it felt like home, but at the same time, we were also surrounded by people that were also struggling. We were there, but we were not rich. You know, we came from nothing. We're talking about like absolutely nothing. I remember like the first few houses that we had or apartments that we had were really, really run down. Every night was cold, and you know, we were all sharing like maybe a single bed. And some of us opted to sleep on the floor. You know, it was that type of situation. Was that really trauma? Not necessarily. I think I was a little bit too young for that. But the things that were really ridiculous that happened in my life were, I guess, back then. I mean, you were around during that time, I'm guessing.
I'm a child of the 70s, yeah. So I was born like 67, so I've been around a bit.
Right. So, I mean, in the early 80s, mid 80s to 90s, you know, racism was pretty prominent. And we're not just talking about cultural racism. We're talking about, you know, the prejudice of, you know,
Immigrants
being
against
within the
immigrants.
vicinity of like class.
Yeah,
So
immigrants are
just
always a problem. Like I lived in outside of Boston in the 70s, and I lived in Springfield, Mass, for a
nice.
while. And I live in New Hampshire, and so there is this kind of thought that Northeast is more liberal. But like, you ever been to South Boston, and you're a black guy walk through South Boston, you might run into some trouble. You know, in the 1970s, I was living outside in a town called Stoughton, and they didn't like busing. And my dad was actually got us into a neighborhood where we could get to a good school because he was an insurance guy. He was a manager. So we're living in this suburb that didn't have any other African Americans in it. So first day of school, they were like, "We don't want any busing kid here." I said, "Well, I'm not a busing kid. I live here." So I understand what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, class is one thing, race is another thing. I don't think I was met with a lot of, I guess, racial prejudice. I think it was more class, if anything. You know,
Perfect, yeah.
I'm showing up to school with like, you know, the same clothes I wore like the day before, and you know, things of that nature. It wasn't a good look. You know, we were in public school. I was having free lunch, and you know, it's just one of those mentalities where like, oh, you know, you're a free lunch kid.
Yeah,
I
but
mean,
you get that class bullying because they're like, "Oh, you're the free lunch kid, or you're on this program, or you're in this special program," and then suddenly, the bullies start going and acting out because, like, "Oh,
right.
you're in this group." You've run into that classism structure.
Yeah. I mean, I think I suffer from like hyper empathy, if anything. The things that happened to me, I wasn't too worried about. I was this geeky, nerdy looking kid, like hat. I used to wear my pants like all the way up to my chest. It was insane. I mean, I was like the Asian Urkel. It's kind of stupid.
Oh
But
yeah, like nerdy. I was.
but like the hyper empathy that I'm talking about was, you know, it was how my parents were treated. You know, the way I see other people treat my parents. That was like It was mind-boggling to me because I get it. Like me facing that type of adversity during that time. But to see it happen to, my
Your father
dad, or to
and
see
your
it
mom.
happen, right, especially to my mom. I love her to death. My dad, I'm sure he did everything he can to be a great father. I think his lack of understanding of, the cultural world, or, where we are, in terms of like how things are done here versus how things are done in the motherland. Like the treatment that I had from my dad was actually a little bit more sensitive. If anything, he was a very angry person lots of time. And, I'm pretty sure in the 80s, everything was like, oh yeah, just beat your kids, it'll turn out, better for them. Which may have been the case, to be honest with you, but
That's a
I'll tell you
70s
what,
thing
I,
too. Yeah, a 70s
yeah.
thing. I mean, yeah, the idea that disciplining your kids with a belt or slapping them in the 1970s or late 60s, like that's what people thought parents would do. You
Yeah.
know, it got more evolved by you get to the 90s and the 2000s, like, oh, you shouldn't do that. But
Right.
you ask my parents and they're old school. They're like,
Yeah.
the kid's doing something wrong, they're gonna get a slap in the
Yeah, I
butt.
mean,
So
my dad's way of I guess reinforcement, his way of reinforcing certain things, he I think he goes a little bit overboard. It was just his way. It was just his way. He, I'm pretty sure he didn't want to be, but at the same time, I'm not sure if he to be honest with you, I'm not really sure whether or not he lost sleep that night either. So it's
that might
just
have been
one of
something
those
that
things.
he experienced as a kid, and then
Absolutely.
it's like a traditional thing culturally. A lot of cultures don't have a problem disciplining their kids at levels that other cultures would be like, what? And
Right.
they don't get it. But it's like, if you're coming from a different cultural perspective, there's like disconnects between like what
Right.
you do there and what you do here.
I mean, I remember so many details living in those apartments back then, back in Lowell. I mean, we were in a dirty part of town, I guess you can say. I think it was like the grimiest of the grimiest, if I'm being honest. I wouldn't want to live there anymore. I mean, I've driven by there some time ago just because I felt a little bit nostalgic. It's a 2.5 hour drive from where I live now, and I'll tell you what, as I drove by there, this wave of emotion, it wasn't that feeling of pleasant nostalgia. It was more like a sense of foreboding, to be honest.
Oh,
It was
go back
kind of a
there.
creepy feeling. Yeah.
If you're going back to that kind of, yeah, if you're back to a negative experience, then it's gonna have kind of reverberations from that time. Like if you, I remember going back to certain points where the bullies, like
Yeah.
in Stoughton, Mass, if I went back to the street where I was like bullied on the first day of kindergarten, it kind of brings me back. I still remember it now, and I'm like 56. So
Right.
I remember that place, that time, when things were kind of not so great. So certain things, they kind of stick with you, and they like those places kind of have a vibe if you believe in
Yeah,
that.
yes, they do. I mean, I've been to Stoughton. It's better. It's a little better now. We're not talking about 80s Stoughton. We're talking about
Yeah, but I'm
it's
upset in
more.
1872 Stoughton. It's
It's
a totally different world than it is now.
a to I think it's a totally different world everywhere. Unfortunately, where I grew up, it hasn't changed much. It hasn't changed much at all. I remember one day we had, I guess it was, you could call it a hate crime. One of our windows got smashed by having some kid, some neighbor kid, threw a rock right through our window, right? It broke the window and then it landed right on my sister's jaw.
Oh wow.
Boom,
I actually hit her.
smashed.
You had to go to
Yeah,
the
it hit
hospital.
her.
Did you have to
She
go to
had to
the
go to a
hospital?
hospital.
Yeah.
And that was the one thing that I remembered about my dad, how in a way he that day he became a hero to me. it doesn't take away from, you know, other things that I didn't like about him, but you know, I can accept the fact that he was being the best dad that he
Could
thought
be at the
he
day,
could be.
yeah.
I remember him immediately reacting to, you know, that rock being thrown into the window and then hitting my sister. He, you know, ran out the door, chased after the kid, and I swear to God, he probably ran for like, you know, a mile chasing after this kid.
Wow.
And you know, he finally got him and wrung him by the neck, and swear to God, he almost did something that you know, that could have landed him in jail for a while. But he resisted. But then it boggles my mind how is it that you can resist, you know, the temptation to just beat this kid into a pulp, but you can't do that with your own kids. You know,
Yeah, that's
in a way,
weird.
he was a hero to me, and I loved that the decision he made that day, I loved it. But at the same time, you know, him
Does
being my
you carry it
hero is
forward,
also
carry it forward to your life at home? It's
right. Why
like,
couldn't
how
that
come we
happen?
can't have that separation there? How come we can't figure that out? You know, and
Yeah.
it's like some folks are in their place where they are. My pop had his problems, and he was never going to kind of get out of his. The way he was raised was very kind of stuck. He's kind of stuck in a cycle. You get like some family members and families like finally break cycles because they start to like look at things and say, well, it doesn't have to be that way, right? And then you start to question it and you talk about it and you don't just push it down and say, well, you know, just suck it up. That tends to be like the American way a lot of times until we got more involved and say, maybe you shouldn't just suck it up. Maybe you should like analyze it and figure out what you can change.
Right. I mean, it didn't occur to me until much later on. Back then, you just accepted it. You know, you take it in the chin. You know, whatever it is that your parents said, you better listen to them, or else it's going to happen again. And that's how we learn from it. You know, I guess it's probably not the right term for it, but that was considered negative reinforcement. I mean, being past that, there were other things that were more traumatizing in my life moving forward. And I think my passion and the artistic side of what it is that I do for a living, I think it originated from me just being like ridiculously lonely. You know,
Yeah.
growing up as an immigrant, as you know, as the second youngest of my family, you know, being a middle child sucks. It really does.
Valley.
And
I get it.
so I, you know, my older brother, my oldest sibling, I mean, he got everything. You know, I think my parents bought him like three new cars when he was like, you know, at different, at various
Firstborn.
stages of his life.
He's like the firstborn type of role.
Yeah, who was a firstborn. And they always, I mean, he was actually my role model growing up. You know, I don't think I necessarily had, you know, a positive male role model in my life, being that the closest person to me was actually my dad. And I didn't like the way he, you know, handled certain things.
Yeah.
But my brother, you know, I thought he was like the best thing in the world. I was like, you know, he was my hero. I mean, I idolized him. You know, he was the one that actually he was the first one to inspire me to get into illustration. You know,
Wow,
I grew up with
what did he
illustration.
tell you? What did he tell you to make you want to do that?
He did it himself. I mean, he fell in love with a girl at a certain point in his life. I think it was right before high school. And overnight, I guess he hung a picture of her on his wall. It was hand drawn and it looked exactly like her. I walked into his room. this is years later, by the way. I mean, we've moved out of the slum and all that stuff, so we're fast forwarding ahead. My parents ended up having better jobs and whatnot, but he hung that picture on his wall, and I walked in and I was like, oh my god, that's amazing. You know, you had somebody do this or something? He's like, no, I drew it. I was like, I never even knew you had this talent. Like, all of a sudden, it just, this hero of mine, you know, crafted something that was absolutely amazing. And I was like, oh, I want to do that too. I never knew I even had had, you know, the talent for it until I actually put pencil to paper. And, you know, out of nowhere, I became the artist in the family. It wasn't him. It wasn't, you know, my adjacent older sister. She was absolutely talented as well. But eventually it was me where, you know, those guys did it. And like my brother and sister, they both did illustrations, but it was more, you know, as a hobby. Whereas I found absolute passion in it. I was like, oh my God. I mean, just the idea of creating something. And that and poetry, those were the two things that I loved most growing up, and you know, during my stage of adolescence. You know, I actually found comfort in that. Having friends are fine, but being in your own headspace and feeling comfortable with it, I mean, that was new.
That's like the artistic, that's the artistic capability that people don't realize, is the ability to be kind of, to be able to be at peace with yourself, right? To actually be able to entertain yourself, or be able to have, like, you can be by yourself. You don't need to be in the crowd. Some folks seem to be like, they can't really operate unless they're with other people. Artists tend to need quiet time. If you're an author, painter, any type of artist, all levels of artists, a lot of times they need that space to be private space to actually collect their capability and do it. And then people wonder, like, well, how can you do that? Because you can be focused, right? And you can actually find a way to express yourself without having to be entertained by other people.
Right. I mean, I got to tell you, I think having discovered that about myself, it also emphasized on the fact that I was a massive introvert. I'm being honest with you, like this whole interaction that we're having together right now scares the crap out of me. I feel so ill prepared, and I feel like I ramble. I feel like I don't even know
what I'm talking about. It's gold. This is the kind of my trade is to bring this out of people is what I do.
So I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
It's the gold of what I do, is to get to the heart of what people are, who they are, which is what you've been talking about. So
thank you. No, I really appreciate that. Part of what it is that I'm trying to do better about myself is understanding my flaws. And that, number one, is public speaking. You know, being an introvert, I think that scares the bejesus out of most people. I'm actually forcing myself to get into, you know, situations that are a little bit more, you know, uncomfortable. I'm not saying that this is uncomfortable. Meeting you is awesome. You know, you're such a great host. You're, you know, very inviting. We're having great conversation. But it's just the atmosphere of having to interact with someone that I've never met before. It brings shivers to my spine.
Well, it's cool that you're at a point where you can actually be here, because there's a lot of people, they want to push that button and actually do it, and they just can't, and you're here. So you've already,
I mean, I've been hovering on that button, on that return key, for the last year, and it's only just recently where I had the stones to be like, all right, let's just do it.
Well, that's cool. I congratulate you, because that's like the step. Like, when you, like any artist, like the day you take it out of your head and then put it on paper, and then the day you take that piece of paper and show it to somebody, it's right. Like a couple of steps. It's like, you got to have the step to actually put it on paper. Then you got to have the step to actually show it to somebody. And a lot of people have that hard time with the step from having it exist and then actually sharing it.
Right.
That's a big leap that some people have a hard time getting to.
Yeah. I mean, that on top of many other things too. I mean, I think I decided like long ago that I was going to be a starving artist. I think I made that decision. I mean, there were other options, you know. I guess I probably could have gone into like engineering and all that stuff. I mean, I love the digital space. But eventually I was like, you know what? My passion is writing and illustration. And then it grew to something that it's a little bit more digital and it became design, you know. So finally, you know, working on applications such as, you know, Photoshop, Illustrator, InDesign, all that stuff, at a very young age actually prepared me for the world that I'm in now. But I didn't know it back then. I always thought that, hey, you know what? I'm gonna do what I love and I'm gonna starve doing it. All right. What's the point of living if
That's
you're
the
not gonna do
aesthetic.
what you love?
Yeah, that's the typical artist aesthetic. And then what happens is sometimes that starving artist is gives you the discipline to do it because you do it because you love it. Then you
Right.
actually create like a brand, right? You actually create a style. And then you
Right.
eventually realize that there's nothing wrong with monetizing that, right? There's nothing wrong with actually sharing that. Or
Right.
and then you actually can fully actualize and wow, I can actually do this as a career. Because
Right.
it's like a lot of times it's like the limitation. We have a limitation that, well, there's no way I could do that as a career. It's just a passion play. And then you
Right.
find out that you can. It's like, oh, it's like epiphany.
Right, right. I have two regrets in my life, Phantom. I have two regrets in my life. One of them is no longer a regret, and the other one is, man, I wish I had discovered what my talent's actually worth, and I wish I had taken advantage of that a lot earlier. You know, I think, oh my goodness, I want to say like maybe the discovery should have been about 15 years ago, if anything. But I only made that discovery and made that decision only just 4 years ago when I eventually ended up starting my own business. Prior to that, I was struggling. So we're talking about the one regret that's no longer a regret anymore. That one regret was not going to college, right? The decision I made was, all right, I'm going to be a starving artist. Nothing's going to change my mind. And, you know, my parents were pushing me in all sorts of directions. It's not like I was failing, you know, school or anything. I was bringing home good grades. It's just that, you know, I had no passion for any of that. Growing up as well, my parents also had like, you know, a few failed businesses. Nonetheless, when they did have those businesses, when during the times that it was thriving, I wouldn't say it was failing, I guess. By the time they sold it, I guess they walked away with more money than they put into it. So that works out. But during that time, you know, they were such a stickler for like saving money that, you know, they had their kids come in and, you know, help out at the shop. I opted to have more homework just so I didn't have to do any of that. You know, it wasn't playtime for me. I mean, people get to go home, play basketball and all that stuff and whatever, spend time with their friends. I maybe had time to spend with my friends maybe once a week, you
Yeah.
know. And growing up at that age, you have to have your kids play with other kids. It's just one of
Yeah.
those things. But
That's just standard.
I grew up in an atmosphere where I felt like I had to work and I wasn't getting paid for it. And it was something that I didn't even want to do. There was no passion in that. I mean, I couldn't even sit in the corner and draw or anything of that sort. So, in a way, I think my parents kind of hindered my productivity into where I'm going, where I was heading towards, like today. So the regret that I had was ultimately I made the decision that, hey, I'm not, you know, living my life for them. Right. I understand what it is to be poor. I understand what it is to not have a lot of money. And I'm actually comfortable with that. I'm not the type of guy that's like, hey, one day I'm gonna own a cruise ship and, you know, sail the world and like, you know, be a multi-millionaire and all that stuff. I just want enough to be happy, to raise my kid and you know, be humble about my life. And so once I laid that, it wasn't much of a plan. It was just a decision. All right, I'm not going to go to college. I'm not going to spend any more money than I have to, because I already know what it is that I want to do. The regret came when, you know, when I had to try to find jobs in my field.
Yeah, they're looking for it. Yeah.
I can't tell you how many resumes I threw out there, and, you know, not a single call back. And, you know, it was disheartening. Over the years, that's all I did. I was a professional resume writer at that point, although I wasn't getting paid. So I'm using the word professional wrong. I was, you know, I was a specialist in resume writing, because I'd written so many. And the number one thing that, you know, they're looking for is a college degree. And it baffles my mind because of the field that I wanted to get in, and it was design. I had all this amazing things that I could show them in my portfolio, and yet they still needed proof that it's like a gate.
You know, the problem with the industry, there's a gate that's sometimes not related to your capability. I mean, it happens in the arts all the time. Yeah, precisely. All kinds of people never went to Berkeley, right? Never right. went to London's, you know, School of Music, and never went to any seminary like area where they could have really. There's a lot of people like Hendrix never went to any of those places. You know, the right. Beatles didn't go to those places. But everybody expect, oh, you got to go to that to be that. No, you don't. Like, there's a lot right. of people that can be through the school of life and passion, get to a skill level that the schools don't even teach, right? So right. I think the world today is starting to accept that because of the different delivery systems of online. And now you can present. What you
yeah, we were born do. In the wrong era.
yeah, that old time, you couldn't do that because the net wasn't at their level. Well, now you can actually use the net, and you can actually make relationships with people all over the world, not just your neighborhood, and show right. people what you can do. And now companies are actually starting to realize, not every creative person comes in a box. Sometimes they have a capability and we want to use them, and they don't have the degree. And right. maybe that's a good thing. As a freelancer, you could go do it. And it's like, yeah, this person is doing what I want them to do. Why do I need that gate of the degree? I don't need it. If they're actually doing what I want, what do right. I need that for?
Right. I mean, why do you need proof when you need a designer, you know, that's capable of doing these things? I'm showing you a portfolio of things that I've done that I, by the way, I was completely self-taught. And this is before Google. This is before, you know, YouTube, where you get taught how to do everything online. Like, everybody can do anything just by clicking on YouTube. Mm-hmm. No, I learned everything in the design spectrum by myself through what we said earlier. It was, you know, making mistakes. Through making all those mistakes, learning new applications, and then understanding how to utilize it even better, that's what came about with my craft. It took a little bit longer than having somebody to teach me, but at the same time, I was so passionate about it that I probably would have cleared a course, you know, faster than any other student, just because I love doing it so much.
Yeah, if you love what you do, then it shows. Right. And then it's like the law of attraction. Like, people, right. once they see your work, then that's the evidence of the work. So right. you're like, what the degree is kind of like, you know, it's like window dressing on top of something that's actually functional. Right. You have right. a functional expert. That happens a lot. There's a lot of people that they find, you know, they have capabilities, and the degree has nothing to do with the capability. I mean, I had a sociology degree. I'm in comp sci. I mean, I'm doing design work for software design, but my sociology degree has nothing to do with that.
Right.
It's like a gate. It was a gate. My interest, I would go hang out with hackers and hang out with programmers, and I never took a comp sci course, but I liked right. it. I did it as right. a passion thing.
Right.
They're starting to understand that now with people. It's like, oh, it doesn't have to fully connect.
Right.
You know,
I mean, it baffles my mind. And that was essentially the final straw for me. You know, I got laid off from a company that I was fully in love with. you know, I used to work at Hasbro, by the way, if you can't tell from my background.
Yeah, see.
I design most of those things that you're seeing in my you know, in this room. But it came to a point where, you know, they laid me off, me and like 1,000 other people they laid off. I mean, it was a sad time for me. Heartbreaking, you know. It was tough coming home telling my wife, like, oh yeah, the job that I love so much, I'm no longer doing, you know, I'm no longer commuting 30 minutes there, you know, every single day and 30 minutes back, and, you know, doing that 60 hour on that 40 hour salary anymore. It was actually just as bad as how I'm describing it. You know, I worked long hours, produced amazing stuff, and then I was laid off, you know, unexpectedly.
A corporate benefit of the corporation. Yeah. There's like, you're a widget, you know. The problem with, you know, like, they don't like sometimes have that family business kind of feeling, like, do you really care about the employees, or do they just look like, are they just numbers? And then that right. starts to make you kind of look at the world like, okay, if that's the way they look at me, then I need to look at things like at me a different way, and start to, like, I'm going to value right. myself and then come up with a new paradigm.
right. I mean, you know, I was there for many years. And then just the thought of having to start over. Oh, my goodness. You know, I have to go through that rat race of sending out resumes all over again. It, you know, it was killing me. And then finally, I connected with a very, I guess, a very known company, another Fortune 500 company. They were very interested in me, had me sign all the papers. It was like, oh, we can't wait for, you know, to have you with us and stuff like that. And I was like, all right, a new beginning. And then we had a third interview, even though I signed all the papers, and they asked me, hey, we don't see any of your college credentials here. and that was it. I was like, yeah, but you see my portfolio, you see my references, you can make a call right now. I mean, I worked at Hasbro. This is like one of the most popular and most creative, you know, companies that you could work for.
Yeah, and really, you think that would be enough. Like, if you've shown that you work there, you're doing it. So why do you, you know, why do you have to have that gate?
Right. Item?
But, you know, some people are so traditional.
So traditional.
That they can't get out of that paradigm. But, you know, the way the world is now, I think it's starting to, like, people are starting to, you know, there's a lot of kids today. It's like, I'm not paying to be in debt to something right. that's really not adding value if I can do it another way. If I can get certificates, if I can figure it out, if I can go internships, if I can go do these, you know, learn to be apprentices and figure things. There's a lot of people doing things in that way because it's like, I why am I going to be in debt?
Right.
If it's not really going to give me what I want.
So that was the regret. That was the peak of my regret. I just got turned down after being accepted from this job that I, that was such a good fit. They loved my stuff. I mean, they see my portfolio, they love my stuff, and then all of a sudden, you know, it's that last minute rejection where I was like, all right, that's the last straw. I am done with corporate. I am done with everything. I'm just gonna open my own business, right? Started it for maybe a year. And I was amazed, like absolutely amazed, surprised, taken aback, just baffled at the idea that I was making already in my first year twice the amount that I was making when I was at Hasbro.
Because you're passionate and you're good. And the thing is, the gate has nothing to do with your ability. The gate is absolutely the way that they try to weed out things because they think that's a criteria they need to have. It's like an unnecessary criteria. You discovered it.
Right. I wish I discovered it sooner. It's like I told you, Phantom. You know what? Immediately, that regret was no longer there. You know, I am living life right now with a great job. I mean, no debt. You know, that's... How many people can actually really say that?
Yeah, you know?
Coming from my background too.
Yeah, they're starting to figure out because the debt we're loading this debt because it's like a societal, like, norm. to say, oh, you got to have X because that's to get through the gate. But if X is going to make you like not financially viable for like 15 years and you could do it a different way, why can't you entertain that? Because, you know, my daughter is in design and she decided to go like her own route and she didn't go get her degree the traditional way. She's been doing a lot of internships and apprenticeships and being in programs and stuff. And then she's getting to where she wants to be, like the way your story is.
Yeah. You know? I mean, there's so many ways to get to where I am. I think it took the long way to get here. I mean, I think she's doing it right. I definitely took the long way here. And if I was a smarter man, I think I probably would have figured it out sooner. But it wasn't without the help.
You were kind of told that that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, you were trying to follow.
Oh yeah.
Everybody thinks you got to be in a Fortune 500. Like everybody thinks that that's the way you get success. And then a lot of times, like now in this world, there's a lot of micro entrepreneurs, right? There are a lot of people are saying like, why can't I sell my wares or my services and build my own, you know, company? Cause you can't.
Right.
And, you know, with a lot of the tools now with the 3D printers and all kinds of things, there are people that are able to build things without the infrastructure of a big company.
Right.
There are people that are to create micro little companies that are like, wow, they can do stuff that nobody else would even do because they have so much overhead and you don't have all that overhead. So you can do a lot of things that are beyond what the big guys can do.
I mean, no, it's insane. Before I think I was making $72,000 a year. And that was the peak of my corporate pay. The peak of my corporate pay was somewhere around like 80 grand. All right. And then immediately after venturing out on my own, my lowest annual, you know, income is 150. It can be anywhere between 150 to $300,000 a year. And I just, you know,
that's being an entrepreneur.
it's into the wheelhouse of me. I don't need to be like insanely rich. I don't. I mean,
yeah.
That's enough that's for me to raise my kid.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's where people. Yeah, because a lot of people think like I need $1 million, but the stress with the $1 million job could like kill you. Like if you can be comfortable with what suits your requirements, right? You can handle your mortgage, you can handle your bills, you have extra money, you can save, you know, you have a health plan. Then you don't need $1 million. Like, what is it you're trying to do? Do you want to be in charge of your own destiny? You don't necessarily need the $1 million job to be in charge of your destiny.
Right? I still like having some surprises in my life. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's like the stress of trying to be the big ticket guy is actually sometimes something you don't want. You know, sometimes you'd rather, like some artists, we could live on a tier where, you know, I'm not doing like you think of like the big guys, like, you know, Taylor Swift, right? You can be Dr. Dre. You get these big guys, right? You said, well, you can't be an artist unless you're a big guy. But you can actually be a singer-songwriter that maybe only has 100,000, 50,000 fans if you don't live like you want to be Taylor Swift.
Right.
You could actually be successful at a smaller level. You could sell your merch. You could sell.
And so you're
you
still can, doing what you're passionate about.
Yeah, you can do what you want. You don't get dropped from the label. You don't get laid off. Because you control your – you're never going to get laid off, but you're always going to be able to book your own stuff, sell your own merch, sell your own vinyl, sell your own products. Because, like, if that's what you want to have, you can have that control without having their overhead. So that's a different world today. Like you can be a successful person without thinking like you got to keep up with the Joneses.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, I grew up, you know, having that rule, almost a policy in my head that this is the way, this has to be the way, you know, corporate life is the dream. I mean, I was psyched when I got hired by CBS and I got, so, you know, I was out of my mind when, you know, Hasbro finally decided, hey, you're good enough to be amongst us. You know, I was surrounded by extremely, extremely talented, creative people. And then when it all just went away, it just you know, I just finally gave up on the idea of, hey, you know what, I'm done working for the man. I'm
You
just
never
done with
know.
it.
They always want to pull you back in. The next thing they see, the CEO is like, "Oh, let's bring him back in." But like you have to decide, like, I don't like that. Right? If I
Right.
you don't like that structure, if you don't like the bureaucracy, if you like to be able to kind of be controlling your vision, like a lot of times,
Right.
if you're an artist and like if you're independent, you can control your content, you can control your vision, you can control your aesthetic, you can control your brand. If you're with
Absolutely.
somebody else, they kind of control what you're going to do. Right. And so the having the freedom to control your own brand, that might be the goal. Like rather than making $1 million, that you will control your brand, because that's your brand, that's who you are.
Right. I
And I
mean,
think
I'm
that's the goal, right?
it is. It's the absolute goal. You know, I think ultimately is being comfortable in your own shoes, keep doing what it is that you're doing and hoping to have that positive outcome, but at the same time working hard to actually achieve that. You know, it's not, I don't think it's 100% luck. I think for me, a
Sounds like
great
a
deal of
hard
luck had something to do with it. A great deal of
work.
luck ha you know has something to do with it, but it's not without the assistance of very, very hard work. You know, and the tenacity to finally, you know, be at the peak of your game, but at the same time, you know, discovering that there's more, that there's more opportunity for you than just, you know, being a desk jockey for a corporate company. You know what I
Well, I
mean?
think it's a great story, and I hate to cut it off, but we're always like it takes always takes like the time goes by so fast, and we already hit the hour. But I think
I
it's
appreciate it.
really, really cool what you're talking about, because there's this entrepreneurial spirit and being independent and wanting to control your destiny is like that's the that's why people come to America, because they want to be able to make their own business, make their own way. That's the point. And a lot of times that's gotten like, oh, you got to join this big corporation, conglomerate. Is that really like, no, I want to kind of be the Henry Ford. I want to be my own Henry Ford. Not that I want to make all the money that Ford makes, but the fact is I want to be able to have my own vision. And so I think your story is very, very cool. And I want to let people know on your web page, if people connect with you, is that how they get in touch with you to get, to work on projects?
Yeah, absolutely. Hit up chimeric.com, Chimeric, .com, and you know, come check out my work. You know, we can direct message each other through there. You know, you can access my portfolio that hasn't been updated for like the last 5 years, by the way. So I don't have any new stuff on there, but you can still, you know, peruse all the old stuff that I have worked on in the past. And get a feel for at least my design style, and hopefully this podcast, you know, give them a sense of my personality as well. I'd like to think that I'm fun to work
Oh, you seem like
with.
I would say from talking to you, I'm very intrigued by everything that you talked about, and I do encourage our audience to click on that link as we are published on all the platforms where you can listen to or watch a podcast. Every platform that exists for that, you'll be able to click through on that link, and you don't have to remember it, because if you w watch this on Spotify or Facebook or YouTube or Twitch, or listen to it on Apple or iHeartRadio, you'll be able to click through on that. Everywhere that we're published will be published there tomorrow. We were live on Twitch, Facebook, and YouTube. And I want to thank you for being a guest on the Family Electric Ghost podcast.
I had such a blast, Phantom. Thank you so much for having me.
We're great. Like I encourage people to check you out, because I think you're a cool guy, and they ought to check out what you can do for them.
Thank you so much.